Eastern Oregon today. But for us, we're
amazing. Are you ready?
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
I'm going to line dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank that speaker.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. One of the things that's happened recently that I'm really pleased by, I went to public school, Tina went to public school, meaning the government-run failing schools that fail kids today. And yet, there are increasing efforts to get kids a different choice, and parents and taxpayers as well. And Chantal Lovell joins me now, Vice President of Communications at EdChoice. Chantal, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So we now have, what, a total of about 18 states that have overt school choice plans and a lot of states that offer some school choice. Is Oregon likely to be able to get a vote on this and maybe put it on the ballot so citizens can decide?
Well, hopefully it'll be up to voters to decide this November whether Oregon will join the growing number of states parents the freedom and flexibility to choose how and where their children are educated. There's currently an effort to get this on the ballot. The organization running it is called Let Them Learn Oregon. I'm not affiliated with them, but my understanding is they have a month to gather signatures to put it before the voters and let voters decide what, unfortunately, lawmakers in Oregon are choosing not to do.
Now, they've got to get enough signatures to get it on the ballot. It's worked out really well in places like Arizona, hasn't it? Wasn't it amazingly popular when passed by Arizona just a couple of years ago?
It has. We now have, like you said, we have nearly 20 states that have programs called education savings accounts, which is sort of the gold standard of school choice. That's what we have in Arizona. Education savings accounts would give a family a portion of the money that the government would spend educating their child in public school. And they say, here, you use this money to send your kid to private school. You can tutor them. You can use it for homeschooling expenses if you want. That's what Oregon would be considering. And these programs have really ballooned in popularity, not only in the number of states that are enacting them, we've seen them enacted at record numbers, but also in the number of children participating in these programs, because it really allows parents to send their child to the learning environment of their choosing, whether it's because they want to see something taught in the school or because their child might have some learning differences or they may want to see different opportunities. So we see time and time again that parent satisfaction is off the charts with school choice programs like the one that Oregon voters may get the opportunity to decide.
I guess the objection I always hear seems to come from those with the biggest dollar dog in the fight, and that would be the teachers' unions, who say, we don't like this because it puts our union members' salaries at risk. But if they're delivering the kind of product where parents are told, you can send your kids to this school without charge. I mean, I won't say for free because the taxpayers are still paying for it. But if they say, you can send your kids over here, and it won't cost you anything out of pocket to send them here. And parents say, no, I want to take my kids somewhere else. It doesn't speak very well about the product that the teachers are delivering, does it?
Sometimes it is telling what people protest on. At EdChoice, our bailiwick is research, and we not only research programs, but there's nearly 76 school choice programs across the country of varying types, and we've studied them, and research shows the data is clear that these programs do not hurt funding. These programs are positive overwhelmingly on any metric you might consider, whether it's taxpayer dollars and the impact to budgets, whether it's the impact to public student test scores. They're positive because they introduce a level of competition. With this proposal that Oregon is considering, families would only receive a portion of the public dollars, which is par for the course in any state that has an ESA program. And that means that each time a student utilizes an education savings account and leaves the public school system, the per pupil dollars that are left in the public system go up. So really, it's a hollow argument, unfortunately, from the teachers union, which is somewhat typical for
them.
Well,
and you know, I would hope that long term, if school choice became a standard part of the choices, I would hope that those education dollars would start to equal out at some point. So there'd be an equal amount allocated for a government school to do the job the way they are now, which is not very well, or an amount of money to parents to choose private school, online school, charter school, parochial school, whatever choice they want to make. And it would arguably cause the public schools to improve, wouldn't it? Because they'd see their students leaving and going elsewhere, and their choice would be make what you do better. And if you don't want to make it better, then you're going to lose more kids. And public schools have lost literally millions of kids in the last few years because they don't do a very good job. And parents think they can find a better education for their kids somewhere else.
Our program shows that they improve public student outcomes. So even those students who stay in the public system are benefiting when you introduce a choice component in a state.
Now, what else do we need to do? And should the unions have something to say about this happening? Because every time I've seen the organized opposition, it's usually very well funded, and it tends to be funded by the labor unions and nobody else. And should they be the ones that determine whether or not there's school choice, or should it be the voters?
You know, I certainly don't think they should. We always think it should be up to parents. Be in control of their children's education and should be able to choose where and how their children are educated. Over the last few years, we've seen tremendous growth in the number of school choice programs, whether it be education savings accounts or vouchers or other programs. Last week, Louisiana created a program like this one for all students in the state. Now, in Oregon, the legislature, you know, unfortunately, is swayed pretty heavily by the teachers union. And so it's going to have to be up to voters. But, you know, through COVID and the last few years, when people started seeing what their children were being taught in school, or in some cases were not being taught in school, it really opened their eyes and really started to remind parents that they should be in the driver's seat. And as we see more and more states create these programs, it normalizes it. So I think that Oregon, you know, if it gets on the ballot, Oregon voters could make this happen.
See, and that's been my thought, too, that you say, well, there'll be opposition to it. No, only from the unions. I'll bet if you put this to a vote, and if parents said, well, I get another choice, it means I can still keep my kids in the government-run schools if you want to. But they don't have much to write home about there, because you've got public schools where they literally changed the law and said you have to afford every student a diploma, even if they can't read, write, and count. And imagine sending your kids into that kind of mess. Chantal, thank you very much. That's Chantal Lovell, who is Vice President of Communications at EdChoice. In a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Imagine.
Sometimes the listeners say it best.
Hey, Lars, love your show, and I really appreciate what you do. Boy, you cover more territory in an afternoon than a lonely badger in springtime.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I hope that America's American dream is still alive. I mean, I realized it when I was 21 years old. I managed to just try and do everything I could to make sure that I could buy a house. It had been a desire of me for a long time. I was making about, what was I making? About $8 an hour back then. And I ended up spending about half my take-home pay to make the mortgage payment. And if you say, Lars, no bank would have let you do that. No, they did not. I had a private deal with people I didn't know. This was not family. And I decided it was that important to spend half my take-home pay, about $600 a month, to be able to make the mortgage payment back in those days. These days, that dream is outside the reach of more and more people in a country where mortgage rates, they're hovering right around 7%. They popped up a little bit last week and have then slid back a tiny amount this week. But they're still far too high for most Americans, maybe not most, but close to half of Americans, to be able to afford to buy a house. So I thought I'd talk to our mortgage expert, and that's Nick Shivers, one of the many great supporters of this program through his business, the Nick Shivers Team. Nick, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, it's a pleasure to be here. And a quick shout out, because there's not too many countries that have that statement, the dream. There's not a Swedish dream. There's not a Canadian dream. There's an American dream. And it was because of June 6, 80 years ago, D-Day, a moment in history where so many Americans sacrificed, including my grandfather, so we could have that freedom and what we call the American dream. So let's jump into that. Yeah, the American dream, housing. Big article just came out that Texas, three metros in Texas and Portland are the only four cities that have seen a decline in home values. So I think that's important to look at, because I think, Lars, we've talked about it. How are we going to get more affordability? And if you look at San Antonio, which is values have went down, they're the second most construction in the last 2 years, new construction. Austin, Texas, number three in the country. And Fort Worth, which is the third most appreciating market right now. So those areas, the reason that happened, prices are going down, is because they had the most construction in the nation.
And then now the fourth city is the home to our studios, and that is Portland, Oregon, and it's gone down as well, but I don't think that's because of increasing supply, or is it?
No, Lars, we're not in the top 50 for a new construction being put in the market. The one thing that we've never talked about, I keep saying build more homes, build more homes, build more homes.
You and me both.
But the other reason I guess we see home values is policy matters, Lars, and policy especially in Multnomah County with taxes and restrictions has caused us to start losing value, not only in the core area, Northeast Portland down 5.4% year over year for average sales price, Southeast Portland down 2.5 in Gresham, downtown, you know, in the Pearl District, they lost like 7% last year. We're only down about 1% this year. But policy matters, Lars.
And by the way, let me add to that. On the commercial side, the highest office vacancy rate in all of the United States of America is Portland, Oregon, isn't it?
Yeah. We're about 35%. And that is vacant. Remember, there are a lot of companies that have leases signed all the way through 2024. They don't even count that in the vacancy. So that is,
even though it's effectively vacant because they've split town, they got out of Dodge.
Yeah, ghost. I mean, nobody's coming to the offices downtown. Why would you want to go down there at this point in time?
Well, let me ask you something else, Nick, because at some point, even if rates are high, even if supply is low, there are people who have to sell their house. In other words, mom or dad got a job somewhere else and they're leaving. And they say, we have to sell this house. We can't afford to make a mortgage payment in our, you know, and even rent a place wherever it is they're moving. So they have to sell the house. Are there people out there who are finally saying, well, it doesn't matter if rates are, well, it does matter that rates are high. We're just going to have to drop the price on this thing and move it because we can't afford to make two house payments, the new one where we're moving to and the old one where we're moving from. Is that part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. Lars, understand, a lot of this information seems scary. We are still, even though home values have dropped, we are still at historic home values. That's why the
Seattle, the median cost of a house has now hit $1 million. That's the middle, half or lower, half or higher. $1 million. Who can afford that?
No one. I mean, again, it is, we do not want to see the Europeification of America. Again, it is the American dream. It is for savings. It's the biggest asset and wealth creator in America forever. Now, the problem is we have the Fed that is driving a car looking in the rearview mirror. They took too long to raise interest rates. So the market boomed and you couldn't keep up with the demand. And now what they're doing is they're going, they're starting to see some cracks with the jobs report that just came up. And then they're going to drive this in. The home industry, mortgage, title, escrow, building has been in a recession for the last 2 years. And until they can start looking, instead of driving the car in the rearview mirror, and start making some policy that actually can keep this growing at a level. And again, if we just drop interest rates and don't get more supply, then we have a problem because values start going back up again. And that's also a problem. So we have to be very careful on that, how that works.
Yeah, in fact, the minute the interest rates drop any large amount, aren't people trying to sell a house going to say, well, now that the rates are down, I can jack the price back up. And I don't blame them one little bit for doing it.
Yeah, one of the things that we're seeing, as you know, Lars, is we've dropped 3.3% of population from 2020 to 2023. Now, that doesn't sound a lot, but if you look from 2016 to 2019, our population growth was hovering around 4%. So that's about a 7.3% drop in the last 6 years of population growth.
From positive to negative. And rates have been hovering right at or about 7%. And is there any sign they're going to go down anytime soon?
Yeah, we've seen about 0.31 bips because of the jobs report this week. With, you know, there's start, because remember, the Fed kept saying we need, which is a sad thing that the Fed keeps wanting, we have to have job losses in order for them to change any policy because they don't want inflation to go back up. And we are already starting to see that, even though the initial jobs reports always get revised down after the headlines come out and say, oh, the economy's doing great. And then wait, they revise it down 2 months later, that really the job growth was just mostly in the government sector.
Wonderful. More government, more taxes, more costs for people, more deficit spending, and an economy where the Fed says we're only going to give you the good news on interest rates when you can give you the bad news that we're losing jobs. That's Nick Shivers, one of the great supporters of this program at the Nick Shivers team. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Your emails are welcome. talk@LarsLarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed where you'll find I've got a face for radio.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. If Sleepy Joe was on Jeopardy.
This man, also known as the worst president in United States history, loves ice cream, lounging on beaches, and sniffing children. Joe.
Who is me? Wait, where am I?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And we like to visit with our friend Aaron Mesh, managing editor at Willamette Week, because they come up with some darn good stories. Aaron, welcome back.
Good to be here.
One I've been talking about a lot, in fact, I just did the commentary on it, is the big win for parents who stood up and objected when they said the teachers union is going to try to push pro-Palestinian propaganda on our kids. You can't do that. And they backed down to some extent. I wanted you to be able to take a victory lap because you're the organization that actually found that information out, right?
Yeah, that part's true. I feel like I have to like caution you a little here that I don't have to think this over, and that like you don't necessarily want to like do the mission accomplished banner quite yet. In part because The only thing that the PAT has removed from its website are supplemental materials.
Right.
So there's some teaching materials that they've removed from the website, but the key component of what we reported on Monday, which is the handbook, continues to be up on their website unchanged. And I do think that that most of the concerns that you voiced in your commentary would continue to be concerns you'd have with that handbook.
Well, and in fact, I did make the point to say, so they've withdrawn the lesson plans and that stuff, but they said the union still claims teachers have a contractual right to post Palestinian flags in classrooms for a country that doesn't exist and wear T-shirts with slogans that call for the eradication of Israel and every Jew in it. And I suggested that only parents with kids named Adolf were going to like that kind of thing. But you know, I don't think it's over either, but how often do we see an example of where public opposition actually causes a major and powerful organization like a labor union to back down even a bit?
I mean, I see it like about three times a month because that's what my paper does.
And that's a good thing. Now, I want to talk, and if there's nothing more to say about that, because I agree, it's going to continue to be a fight. But one of the things, before we leave that topic altogether, Aaron, let me put this to you. I got hired to do what I do because I give people my opinion. But for the vast majority of employees of any company, whether you work at Boeing or Nike or Microsoft or Intel or the butcher shop or Nordstrom, you're not hired to use that job as a platform to spread your political ideology. And most bosses take exception to you using your spot at the front counter at Nordstrom or the front counter at the butcher shop or the front counter at a tire store to spread your ideology. They say, leave the ideology alone, just sell tires. And I guess I wonder, what does it say about a group of people, professional teachers, who feel like they get a bum rap from me many of the times, but when they say, yep, I've got a job, I've got a, you know, this forced audience of your kids who are required by law to be in some kind of education. You sent them to a government-run school, and I'm going to tell them what to think about sex, what to think about Hamas, what to think about 100 different things. That seems incredibly arrogant to me to say, because I have this captive audience of your kids, I get to school them on all of these things while I'm not teaching them reading, writing, and math.
So, you know, I have my views on this, and I'm also not necessarily paid to offer them. But let's say that there's a...
Would it make a difference if I paid you? I'll give you $5, Aaron. Give me $5 worth of your opinion.
Well, $5 of opinion isn't going to buy you very much. I'm much more expensive than that.
Oh, my goodness.
But, however, having said that, let me offer a few hypothetical opinions that a person could have that that I might or might not share. What if someone were to say to you that that they send their kids to school because they would like them to learn how to do algebra, and they are not particularly interested in the kids learning about the boycott, divest, sanctions movement, and they're not particularly interested in having the teachers read them the Bible. They're not especially interested in prayer in school. They just want their kids to learn the friggin' algebra, which
I would have
to say would be pretty close to where should I have a kid in a public school system where I would want to land. Is that we can read the Bible or the Quran or any book we want to at home.
And Aaron, I'm actually with you on that, that if you're going to teach some religion, you should teach all of them. You know, if you want to do a survey course that says, we're going to teach about the Quran, we're going to teach about the Torah, we're going to teach about the Bible, and maybe even, we'll throw in some Hindu and Tibet as well, okay? Maybe even some Uyghur Muslim. We'll throw that in as well. If you want to do it, you have to do it for everyone. You can't teach the five pillars of Islam and then say, but you can't, we're not going to teach the Ten Commandments, even though this is a country founded by Christians that is still predominantly Christian. I'm for keeping the politics out. Even when I agree with the politics, I'm pro-life. If somebody said, do you want teachers to start indoctrinating kids to a pro-life point of view? No. But if the subject comes up and you're going to teach them about Planned Parenthood and how Planned Parenthood can dispose of that inconvenient little pregnancy you've got, then you should teach them about the alternatives as well and both points of view, either all points of view or nothing, either all religion or nothing, and otherwise teach them algebra, teach them how to read, write, and count, which, by the way, they're not doing right now by the school district's own numbers. So I don't see how they have time to do the...
I'd probably be a little less grouchy about this if I thought that our educational test scores were, like, anywhere near the rest of the countries.
And they're not, are they?
No, they're quite terrible.
One in five kids drops out, and half of the... Go ahead.
I think where it gets difficult is this. Like, and I think this happens in almost every business where people are engaged in, like, a didactic profession, where you're telling people, like, what you think or what... or instructing them on something, is that it is very hard not to feel the spasm of personal conviction when you have strong views on an issue. And I think it is very hard for teachers, like it is for journalists, not to feel like they're betraying themselves and people they care about when they don't offer those views. So I want to offer that level of grace and say that I understand where they're coming from there. Having said that, I do think that if you look over the handbook that the PAT distributed, I personally would find it difficult to square that handbook with the idea that that all viewpoints are being offered rather than...
They're not. I read the handbook. They're not being offered. They're getting one point of view.
That would be my view as your own interpretation of that handbook matches mine.
Well, and I guess what bugs me is, do you remember back during the first campaign with Trump, and somebody said, well, David Duke has endorsed Trump, so Trump's a bad guy, and it turned out not to be true, but David Duke is famously, you know, America's last Klansman or something, and he's a despicable character. But just the connection of this guy has endorsed you, that means you must be bad. This is, they're talking in Palestinians about a group of people who chose Hamas terrorists as their government at the last election they had, who 70% of them say, we support what Hamas did on October 7th. So they're taking the side of a group that is a terrorist organization, according to the U.S. government, according to any sensible person on planet Earth sees Hamas as a terrorist organization that most recently carried out a slaughter of innocents, deliberately of innocents, aimed at women, children, families, and not at the military or anything else. And you say, so you're going to teach the kids that the folks who see Hamas as the heroes, they're the good guys? When are you going to teach them that the Klan is the good guys or some other despicable group? That's what it sounds like to me.
See, here's where I stop, though. Like, this is where I draw the line on what I'm going to talk about, is that you can't pay me
$10
to have a geopolitical opinion.
Okay. Fair enough. Could we at least agree Hamas is a terrorist group?
Sure.
And can we agree that Palestinians chose that terrorist group as their government?
$5.
You'll get the check in the mail, buddy. Just like you get the check from the State of Oregon's Employment Division. It'll come that fast. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Summer.
New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. When I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Seton Motley joins me now, our friend and the president of the group called Less Government. How are you, Seton?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. I'm doing better than Joe Biden, who had to leave the D-Day ceremonies today for reasons they probably will never explain, although some of my audience has already called in to speculate, and I think their speculation may be on target, so let's put it that way.
Unlike Joe Biden. If that doesn't epitomize USA 2024, I don't know what does. If everybody's paying attention, this race would be 95-5 Trump. I mean, it's... And again, you and I have discussed and agreed that the 2020 election was stolen. I just saw Mitch Landrieu, who is co-chair for Biden's reelect, and he said, it's going to be a very close election. And I said, translation, Trump's going to win huge again, and then they're going to steal just enough votes to steal it again. I mean, that's, in any normal circumstance, when you see what happened in the Bronx for Trump happen,
yep.
That's a landslide victory. during the entire 2020 campaign. Trump had huge rally after huge rally after huge rally. And
in Democrat strongholds, right?
Right. And the only time Biden could draw flies is when he had a D-Day moment.
You know what I wonder? You know, when the military flies over a place and they bomb it, they get not just the explosion of their bombs, but then they get the secondaries that come off. What are the secondaries off that Bronx rally? When, because you know, the local news media covered as well as the national news media, when other people of color in New York City who might be sitting on the fence, who might be saying, I don't want to vote for this, you know, this guy who can't, you know, go to the D-Day ceremonies without messing up, literally, that when they see fellow New Yorkers, black fellow New Yorkers, brown fellow New Yorkers, young fellow New Yorkers, and they're on television going, I'm going Trump. And that has to have a secondary effect that would roll out in the weeks after the Bronx, event.
And then of course it got jammed together because soon after the Bronx situation, he gets found guilty of 34 completely fraudulent felony charges. And raises what, $54 million in 24 hours,
and including many people, $200 million in about 5 days.
That's right, and a bunch of people saying, I've never given to any candidate ever in my life, but I gave to Trump after those verdicts. And I put it up on social media, and like literally 5 minutes later, 50 Cent talking, and I said, gee, who knew that a bunch of railroaded fraudulent felony charges being leveled against someone would resonate with black Americans. Who knew
that was the, you know, I saw soundbite after soundbite where black Americans are saying, look, I got railroaded on charges too. Now they have a common cause with Trump, or
that's
members
right.
of their family have fallen. And whether they really were railroaded or not, I don't know. I mean, I've talked to people on the show who've been run up the flagpole for no good reason. And I've also looked at situations where I think, no, the charges against you were real. But no matter what, if this causes them to look at Trump and say, he's a billionaire, he's
that's
nothing
right.
like me, but in this, we have something in common, and it ends up being a positive courtesy of Alvin Bragg.
Alvin Bragg.
And Fannie Joe Willis, Biden.
And ultimately, the Joe Biden administration, not Biden himself, per se, because he's busy doing other things. It's going to cause because maybe these people who weren't paying attention before to the other court cases are now going to have their attention drawn to the other court cases and go, oh my God, it's happening in Atlanta. It's happening, you know, it's happening in multiple venues simultaneously, not just this crappy New York verdict that we just saw handed down. It's really, I think you're right. I think it's going to be residual. But then the question remains, can he win outside the margin of that?
Well, and when you say they're going to cheat, think about this, Seton, because Trump won so big in 2020, as you point out, on the in-person vote, he absolutely
right.
won the popular vote in every one of the 50
All
states.
50 states.
Yeah, that's but right. remember, they cheated, yes. They had to shut down the vote because they realized their cheating was not going to get them over the edge. And in the end, even
right.
in Georgia, even with massive cheating and the shutdown of the count in the middle of the night for no good reason whatsoever, they win by less than 12,000 votes. They cheat by less than 12,000 votes. If the win is big enough, can they cheat enough? You know, that's what it comes down to.
I know numbers don't play well on radio. Trump increased his votes by 11 million in 2020 to 75 million, which would have been the record. As you said, he won all 50 states in person. But Biden somehow, remember, 75 million for Trump, Biden somehow got 81 million, which was 16 million more than Obama and Clinton in the previous two elections.
Which you
now,
cannot
I'm sorry,
believe.
That yep. doesn't resonate. Right. That doesn't resonate with me as truthful and honest and upright.
So if Trump wins even bigger this time, all the people who voted for him in the last election, all the people who feel I got robbed because I voted for him, he won, and now I'm going to definitely make sure I show up, and I'm going to bring a friend to vote as well. When all those people show up, my question is, we used to always say, if you win big, if you win big enough, they can't cheat.
Well, we proved last time that wasn't true. But again, I focus on Virginia amongst first among states because that's where I was born. Virginia's vote law is you can now show up on election day, no ID, and register to vote and cast a ballot. Not a.
Doesn't make any sense. That's Seton Motley from Les Gorman. And Seton, I think you're absolutely right about that. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank that speaker.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I've been looking forward to talking to Justin Hicks, who's a Missouri state rep, but he's running for Congress in Missouri's 3rd Congressional District. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Lars.
Now, the first thing you have to tell me, I've been to your state, and I think it's a very nice state, just in observing that. It's a great state full of great people. I've been to West Plains. I've been to a number of places. But officially, is it Missouri or Missouri? And do I get in trouble for calling it the wrong one?
It depends where you are. It depends where you are in the state. It's Missouri. It depends if you're down in the southern portion. Sometimes it's Missouri is what you hear, but it's pronounced Missouri.
Fair enough. We got that salt. And by the way, the town I've been to, West Plains, I actually got to drive through your state because I had to go to West Plains. I thought it'll be easier to fly in. I forget where I flew into. It might have been Chicago or something. Anyway, I just drove. No, it was St. Louis. And what I did was I got a rental car, and I thought, well, this would be a nice drive. And so I got a couple of hours of looking at Missouri. And then down in the southern part of the state, you're right, they called it Missouri. So tell me this, why do you want to be in the United States Congress? It's kind of a messed up outfit by my estimation, but we could use some good conservatives there. And I understand that DEI is one of your favorite hobby horses, and it's one of mine as well.
Yeah. So the reason I'm running for Congress is because of Liberty. Liberty is actually the name of my one-year-old daughter at home. She's currently growing up in a world where we have a lot of selfish leaders who are more focused on such things as political theater and making money instead of actually making a better future for people. Liberty is growing up in a world where our freedoms are constantly under attack. And I've always been somebody who's been wanting to make sure that we, secure a better future for Americans by themselves. So I did things like serve 6 years in the Army, deployed on a combat tour, and over there, that's where I learned what selfless leadership was. It was to make sure we put others before our own selfish wants to actually get the better outcome for society altogether. And I'll be honest, we're not going to get there with the current Congress and what's going on up there in D.C. because we keep electing the same type of person, the same type of career politicians who waste their time, waste your time, waste taxpayer dollars. What we're needing up there is a fresh new conservative faces who are passionate and willing to put actual policy before the political games out there. And I have a proven track record of that here in the state of Missouri. I've been on the forefront of a lot of the conservative movements, whether that be DEI as an example, being one of the only Republicans of color in the state here of Missouri. I haven't been afraid to speak out about this issue and make sure that people understand that America is about equal opportunity, not equal outcome. And we need more people like that up there to push back against a lot of the left-wing critics that are out there that are saying otherwise. So that's why I'm fighting for a better America, that we make sure that there's a better country for my daughter, for your kids, and for all Americans altogether, that we have a good selfless leaders up there to get better.
By the way, folks, I'm talking to Justin Hicks. He's a Republican. He's now a state rep. But consider this, combat veteran, but also you served a term in the Missouri Attorney General's office. You've done both kinds of combat, both courtroom combat and the real kind.
Yes, I've done both. Done courtroom and the real kind over there. So I'm proven, tested. Want to make sure that we cut through the BS that we see up there in Congress and actually get things done for the American people. Have Congress actually do their job, because at the end of the day, it's a job and they're failing at it right now.
Well, and one of the things that throws me, Justin, you mentioned you're a person of color. And you know, it stuns me that more people of color in the United States, black or brown, don't say, look, we don't need this special help. We don't need DEI to, as you say, achieve equal outcomes. We just ask for an equal opportunity. And in fact, DEI sounds like it can work in a reverse way by saying, oh, Justin, he got into college. He went to college, became a lawyer. Yeah, but he probably got in because of his skin color. I would hate it if people thought I got my job because of my skin color. And I would think most people of color in America would have that same feeling. And yet a number of them seem to have bought into the idea. Do you have a diagnosis of that?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate, but the segment of a lot of people of color have been bought into a lot of the Democrat ideals that are out there, so they just eat it up. I've been somebody that's pursued the American dream in my life. I grew up pretty poor here in St. Louis, and I had to work for everything I got because my father passed when I was 12 years old, and my mom was a hairstylist. So I had to work. I had to do things like go to the military, put myself through college, become a first-generational attorney in my family, and then move on to the assistant attorney general's office, to the attorney general's office, and then being one of the state reps as well. So it's about the opportunities to achieve that American dream. And that's the message that needs to be out there. It's not about free handouts. It's not about the stigma that's out there right now is that, oh, you know, you went to college, you became an attorney, as you mentioned. Is that because of such things as picking people based on colors and putting them through these programs? You know, I don't like that stigma by itself because I've worked for everything I've had, and it's kind of disrespectful because it's reverse. It really is. The DEI movement's reverse by itself. It's saying that you are lesser because of things that don't even matter, such as your skin color, the way that you look. And that's not true. And that's not the message we should be pushing as Americans by itself. America is a place to make sure that we have opportunities. And that's what it's all about. It's about the opportunity to try to achieve something. It doesn't mean you always get it. There's nothing out there that's guaranteed, but having those freedoms to do that there. And that's what I want to make sure that gets across, and that we get good people like myself up there to Congress that really are going to fight for those principles, because I don't want my daughter to be looked at lesser because of the color of her skin, or that she could not do something because of the color of her skin. I'd rather it be judged by her character.
And that's the way to do it, like Dr. King said. So, Justin, tell my audience where they can find your website, find out more about your positions on all the other issues, and a little bit more about your resume. Where do they find you?
Yeah, they can find me at hicksformissouri.com. Again, that's hicksformissouri.com. And I'm just a conservative wanting to make sure that we get common sense people out there that are going to actually move the country forward.
I would hope that when you get to Congress, Justin, when you become Congressman Justin Hicks, I would hope you go in there and say, look, all this money we're paying out to all these private and public schools, not a dime of it goes to any institution that endorses DEI. The money will go to the colleges that actually expect kids to come in and do what you did. Earn your own grades. Don't expect an equal outcome. Just expect an equal opportunity. That's Justin Hicks. He's currently a state rep in Missouri, if you prefer, and he's running for Missouri's 3rd Congressional District. Justin, it's a pleasure. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Lars wants a job for any American who wants one, with one exception.
It's time to tell Crooked Joe Biden, you're fired.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to tell you something. The states of Oregon and Washington, like a number of states around America, not all 50, but they afford citizens under the Constitution the right to make laws and change laws if they so choose. Initiative petitions, referendum, and the like are a good function because they kind of keep the legislature in line. If state lawmakers say, nah, we're not going to pass a law like that, citizens can always go out and decide to pass the laws anyway over their objections, and it's happened often enough. The problem is there's a mechanism in the state of Washington where Bob Ferguson, the attorney general, is running for governor, and God help us, if he becomes governor, he'll be even worse than Jay Inslee, if you can imagine that. He wants or has the ability to put a warning label on initiatives. Now, what that means is that having done all the groundwork to go out and gather hundreds of thousands of signatures to put something in front of the voters or in front of the legislature, that Attorney General Ferguson has the ability to slap a big label on it to try to kill the thing, even as it's being voted on. And State Representative Jim Walsh, who represents Aberdeen in the 19th District, joins me now. Representative Walsh, welcome back.
Oh, it's good to talk to you, Lars. It's been a little while.
It has been. Have I accurately described what it is that Ferguson has and wants to hold on to, his warning label ability?
Yes, you have. It really is a piece of work, Lars. So a couple of years ago, this is a relatively new thing. A couple of years ago, the majority Democrats in Olympia passed this bill into law that creates this so-called fiscal impact statement. That's the warning label. And it allows the state attorney general, currently Mr. Ferguson, in cooperation with the Office of Financial Management, OFM, which is under the governor. So it's the governor and the state attorney general working together. They can concoct this very short statement that attaches to an initiative, a people's initiative, that has gone through the process, qualified for the ballot, on the ballot for people to vote on. They can slap this label on, this fiscal impact statement, that basically they've got a free rein to say whatever they want. And it's chicken little stuff. They massage the numbers until they confess, and they make it sound as bad as it can be, whatever the initiative is.
Well,
and they are using it, or they're trying to use it that way right now, and we're taking them to court and challenging their manipulation and their scare tactics on a couple of good initiatives.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. When they said this is going to be a fiscal warning, in other words, if you said we're going to have an initiative that costs some money, so you can warn the voters, well, yeah, they want to do this, but it would be forewarned it's going to cost $1 billion, that they could slap that kind of label on. But the measures, correct me if I'm wrong, that Ferguson wants to put these on are the measures that were put on the ballot by Mr. Haywood and his efforts, and, of course, 400,000 signatures from citizens. These don't have a fiscal impact, do they? They don't have a monetary impact, but Ferguson says he can still put a fiscal or monetary warning on initiatives that don't have any real fiscal impact to speak of, do they?
Yeah, that's right. They're being very clever. They when they made this fiscal impact bill, they narrowly focused it and said it had to be things that involved the effects on tax revenue to the state, money coming into the state by taxes.
Right.
Well, they also were too clever when they passed the cap and trade scheme here. They said it's not a tax. And they went to great length, they being Inslee and Ferguson, to make these convoluted arguments that the cap and trade scheme was not a tax. Well, the warning label is for taxes. So you can't have it both ways, guys. You were arguing it's not a tax, and now you're trying to argue it is a tax. And that's one of the points we're making in saying that these warning labels are not appropriate to this current group of three initiatives.
Well, Representative Walsh, that's why I keep telling people it's a carbon tax. Now, I understand that's not the formal name of it, but if you say this is going to pencil out to another almost 50 cents a gallon on gasoline, then it's a carbon tax in all but name. And so now they're trying to say the carbon tax is not a carbon tax, but these other things that have no monetary impact to speak of, we're gonna put a fiscal impact, a monetary impact statement on them to try to get the voters to vote them down. And they get it both
ways. The point too is, Lars, they're not, when they do their short fiscal impact statement, they're not saying, you know, it is estimated this will cost X number of dollars. They're going right to the heartstrings. They're getting completely emotional and using scare tactics and saying things like, this will take money away from daycare and child care and early education. That isn't, first of all, it's not true. And second of all, it's not really a fiscal impact statement. It's scare tactics.
So in other words, they can say to the voters, don't vote for this. Because puppies and kittens will suffer, and they're going to get away with it, right? Unless
you're trying to stop them. We filed a lawsuit. We're gonna have a hearing this week, and we're gonna see what the judge says. But I think we're making a pretty strong argument that this is not the right use of a fiscal impact statement. And Ferguson and Inslee have already kind of muddied the water on what these initiatives address. So, you know, they're trying to have it both ways, and we're going to call them on that.
I mean, because if you pass whatever you want to call it, Climate Commitment Act, I know that's the official name, but if you say this is going to peel, you know, $1 billion or a couple of $1 billion out of the pockets of the oil companies, who will be happy to and blameless, I think, in passing the cost along to their customers, and you say, well, you know, that's not a fiscal impact because technically it's not called a tax, but we can go ahead and use it this way. It's so blatantly political. The only problem is, you're in the courts in Washington State, which, including the Supreme Court, seem to be some of the most political instruments of government there are.
That is true. Although we've had some good luck, Lars, lately with the Washington State courts when they ran one of those goofy lawsuits trying to get Trump taken off the presidential primary ballot. We got a pretty good result. They slapped that right down and said, no, he stays on the ballot. So that we've gotten some good responses from the Washington courts, Lars. If we make really strong arguments, we can kind of shame some of these judges into remembering they're judges and not political activists, and we can get a decent opinion out of them. So I'm going to remain optimistic that we're going to make a really strong case against this misuse of these warning labels, and it'll be good for public policy, Lars, because if we're going to have these warning labels, we want them to mean something, and we want them to be focused on specific fiscal impacts to tax policy. We don't want to turn it into a blank check that somebody like Bob Ferguson can write whatever he wants in. We want to keep it narrowly focused so that when it is used, it actually does say something meaningful about tax revenues.
It actually makes sense. That's Representative Jim Walsh from Aberdeen. Representative Walsh, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you want to send an email, talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, dial me up at 866-439-5277. We always put naysayers right to the front of the line. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Introducing the Greek god of lousy economics, open borders, and falling upstairs.
I am Joe Bidenopoulos.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I can remember about 44 years ago going to a press conference as a reporter, because I was a reporter back in the day in both radio and TV. And I sat at this press conference in 1980. And I remember they gave us a big fancy handout, and they said, here is our 10-year plan to end homelessness. Now, even at the time, I thought, okay, 10 years from now, you're going to have solved this problem altogether. And of course, after 10 years, they had not solved the problem. If anything, it had become much worse. But there are literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars being spent by cities and counties all across America to solve the problem of homelessness. And if anything, I think the money actually makes the problem worse. I wanted to put that to Austin Vanderhaden, who is a municipal affairs liaison at the Goldwater Institute out of Arizona. Austin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is all this spending actually doing any good? Is it just neutral, or do you think it's actually making the problem worse? Because I'm not going to say I've done an academic study, but it seems the more money they spend on it, to me, it seems like the worse the problem gets.
Right. So in Arizona, I mean, we've seen homelessness take over the streets of our two largest cities, Phoenix and Tucson. And the city's response, like you said, has just been to spend their way out of the problem. And they're allocating hundreds of millions of dollars since 2021. And it's made no impact, if not gotten worse. So the problem, too, is that the local governments largely won't say where the money's going. So we actually did their job for them here. Two quick things. Phoenix has allocated over $180 million to the homelessness crisis here since 2021. The city can only account for $47 million of that, but the number of homeless people in Phoenix between 2018 and 2023 went up 92%. You look at Pima County, which is where Tucson is, they can only account for $17.8 million of the homelessness spending since 2021. Some estimates are saying that they've spent from anywhere from $27 to $210 million since 2021. Their homeless population has gone up 60% since 2018. So there's zero accountability or transparency, and they're just spending. Is it working? I'll leave that to you to say.
Well, I guess I wonder, how is it possible to spend huge amounts of money like that and not be able to say where it went?
We're wondering the same thing. And you know, they in Phoenix, they work with a small number of vendors. There's this approved vendor list of about five or six different nonprofits, and the money just keeps siphoning through these organizations, and a lot of it is COVID funding, and they're, you know, these cities are open about it, and eventually that COVID funding is going to dry up. So where are these hundreds of millions of dollars going to come from? So it's a huge problem, and I think that it's clear that spending their way out of it is not going to solve this homes problem.
Well, and I wonder about this, Austin. When they put money out in those kinds of quantities, say $60 million a year, every year for 3 years, to get to about 170 or 180 over 3 years. If they say, well, we spent $2 million on this program and we can show the results and they seem to be pretty good. And we spent $3 million over here and it didn't turn into much of anything. At the very least, you'd think they track it so they have some way of saying, this is the stuff that's working, fund it more. This is the stuff that isn't working, drop the funding altogether.
Correct. I would think so. And the reality is that's just not what they're doing. And again, taxpayers deserve a clear and accurate accounting of, like you said, these vast resources that the governments have dedicated to homelessness. Again, if you're spending anywhere from $27 to $210 million, which is an insane range, and you can only account for $17 million of it, we have a problem. And I bet you if you were to go to the city councils, the council members, they probably have no clue, you know, what, how to answer that question. And so I think that's a larger issue than just the homelessness crisis and answering for why this isn't working, because they don't even know where the money's going. And I think, quite honestly, that's part of the reason, right? If you don't know where the money's going and you don't know how it's being spent, how can we know what is and isn't working?
Well, and that's what I wonder, why they're not at least asking the question. You spent all this money. How much did you spend? And when your staff says, we don't know, you say, well, you've got receipts somewhere. Sit down and figure out where the money went and then tell us what you did with it and tell us whether or not it's working. Nobody's asking that?
No, nobody's asking. Actually, it's quite the opposite. They're asking for more money. Phoenix Office of Homeless Solutions, so they kind of run the homelessness show up here, if you will. And they have continuously said, even down in Tucson, they've said that we're about to see homelessness on steroids because the funding for COVID money is going to dry out soon. And so they're asking for more and more money when they can't even allocate or account for what's been allocated. It's just madness. So, you know, if a business was being run like this, you better believe they'd be held accountable. But this is, you know, it's local government and no one really cares. So that's the reality that's happening
here.
Well,
and especially because when it comes time to cut and they know the COVID money is running out, that if they say, well, then if we have to cut, let's cut the stuff that's the least useful. But they don't know what's the least useful because they don't know what is the most useful either.
Correct. Yeah, it's a recipe for disaster, and we're seeing the ramifications of it, and that's why these homelessness numbers are up so much. I mean, that's part of the reason is there's no guidance, there's no direction, there's no understanding for what's happening, and this is the result. And we, you know, you can't really expect anything different to happen when this is the reality that you're facing.
Am I right in suspecting that a lot of these monies, the reason they're tough to track, is that the cities, being political, are going to hand stuff out to groups that they like, groups whose politics they like, not because they're a good service provider, but because, well, this group says they can do some good. They filled out the paperwork. They've asked for a grant. Let's give them some money. They're politically favored. Sorry about that. Got a bad case of the hiccups. But you'd think that that's what they're doing, and I suspect that what they're doing is handing out money to their political allies.
Well, you know, that kind of seems, you know, it's an interesting take. And in Phoenix, they've got that, again, that approved list of vendors. There's no RFPs that go out. There's no, you know, who's going to be the best, and not just for the people on the streets, but the taxpayers. Who's going to be the best? There's none of that. It's just, here's this list of eight vendors or whatever it is that we're just going to continually use for years and years and years, and just keep giving them the money with results seemingly not mattering. So, that's what we're getting here.
I'm talking to Austin Vanderhaeden, but you'd think that short list of approved vendors would be the key to finding out where's the money going. If you're saying you're only handing it out to these eight groups, sit down with a pencil and a piece of paper and say, how much did you pay to group one, group two, all the way through group eight? Now total the numbers up, and if they don't add up to the amount you've already shoveled out, then you're missing somebody from that list. Because it's not as though they can say, well, we have thousands of vendors, so we have no idea how much we've given to each one. And yet that makes it even tougher to believe that they don't know where the money's going, which again makes me suspect it's going to some of their political allies who've just said, hey, you got a pot of money available? Tell us what kind of paperwork to fill out and we'll do it so you can write us a check.
Right. And we've seen some of those things. You know, we've seen the allocation of the $47 million. Out of the 180, and a lot of that $47 million is from, you know, that, hey, we've given this grant to Community Bridges is one of their big ones here in Phoenix and in Arizona, and so they have that allocation, but they don't really have the allocation for what's Community Bridges spending that money on, or they'll say, you know, yeah, we're going to bring X amount of shelter beds, but then there's no follow through on what that is. There's a lot of allocation, but there's not a lot of follow through with, okay, once we've allocated this money, what now? What's that next step? And that's where the frustration is. Because you can sit here and say, you know, yeah, we've allocated $180 million. But if you haven't spent all of it, or you have no clue where it's going, it's impossible to say that you've done anything or been effective in solving this issue.
I think you're right. That's Austin Vanderhaeden. He's the Municipal Affairs Liaison at the Goldwater Institute. We'll be back in a moment. I want to get to your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Did you know Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for almost 24 years now. You wonder, how much do American liberals and progressives hate Jewish people? Well, I thought I'd talk to a Jewish person about it. Ari Hoffman, host of the Ari Hoffman Show on our Seattle affiliate, KVI, whose show follows mine. Ari, how are you?
I'm great, buddy. How you doing?
I'm doing well, but how much do these, when I say liberals, I'm assuming that most of the people who work in the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle are probably not voting for Donald Trump this fall, and they probably didn't vote for conservatives and won't vote for conservatives. Why'd they walk off the job about, what was it, a week ago or so?
You know how they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions? So yes. What happened was the Wing Luke Museum teamed up with a black organization about civil rights and the Washington State Jewish Historical Society. And they created this exhibit where they were talking about racism that each of these communities have faced in Seattle and across the country and, you know, in other parts of their history. And what happened was the staff walked out because they were mad that the exhibit rightfully equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, specifically talking about a synagogue that had been vandalized in the wake of the October 7th attacks with anti-Semitic and anti-Israel messaging all over it. I mean, they hit this thing hard. They climbed on the roof. It was really, really bad. And these workers at this museum think it's wrong to call out hate that they disagree with. So they are so anti-racist that they are now deciding what is actually racism. And think about this, Lars. If somebody who's white, like us, tried to show somebody in the black community how we define racism for them, there would be national outrage over this. But here, instead, what happened is these lefties gave away the game because they're saying, oh, we want to be anti-racist, but not for you Jews, not for you blacks, not for you Asians, because we disagree with what you're saying.
And I imagine there's somewhat of an economic element in it as well, because white people do better generally in America than people of color, and Jewish people do better than non-Jewish people economically. I don't think I'm talking out of my hat, you know, on that, because that's true. And now, what is the reason for it? Lots of reasons behind it, but some of this is economic envy or what?
I think what it is for the left, on the intersectional left, they have these systems of oppression. You fall into one of two classes, an oppressor or oppressed. And they feel, and this is the most racist thing of all, they feel that by the color of your skin, you must be oppressed. And if you're successful, that makes you oppressor, which is how certain people in the black community can use pretty horrible words to describe people who vote Republican who happen to have black skin. Same thing in other communities as well. So if you don't fit that oppressed oppressor mindset, they lose their minds. Jews are 0.1% of the world's population, one of the ultimate minorities. I think the only racial group or ethnic group that has a smaller number than Jews is Armenians. But yet Jews don't get a box anywhere on any forms, nor do we want one, because we don't want affirmative action or any of that kind of garbage. But yet they don't consider us a minority. For us, they consider us oppressors because we have made a success for ourselves in this country.
And by the way, you're not oppressed, even though I think as a people, haven't you been kicked out of an awful lot of places over the last few millennia?
Yes, I think it's, I don't know, about 100 countries.
Yeah,
like
I'm not just talking about the Holocaust. I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about the Romans. I'm talking about the diaspora and all kinds of things like that. I think you could argue, yeah, that was oppression against Jewish people because they were Jewish people, right?
There's a great book by Dara Horn called People Love Dead Jews. I mean, it's a great book to read, but if you have it out on the subway, people are going to judge you. But basically, it shows that the Democrats only really like Jews when they can make a case out of them. For example, in Pittsburgh, at the Tree of Life shooting, when it was an actual white supremacist who did that, they were all over it. But now when you're talking about the hatred coming from the far left, from Rashida Tlaib, from Ilhan Omar, from the college campuses, most of them are silent. Most of them don't want to say anything at all about it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to discuss it, which shows that they just want to use the Jews for whatever their political purposes are.
And it's an element of the elite. In fact, Ari, I'll presage this. My next segment, I'm going to talk about the fact why do working class college students don't do the campus protests, but the very elite, very expensive colleges have them. And I've got some numbers to back it up. Turns out there's a real pattern there. It has to do with Pell Grants and a lot of other things. But at the end of the day, do you think most of the people who talk about and disparage Zionism know what it is?
No, they have no clue whatsoever. Like, here's an example. They always say it has nothing to do with Judaism. Anybody who says that doesn't know anything about Judaism. At the end of the Passover Seder, at the end of the Yom Kippur Davening, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, both of those say, next year in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
It's throughout all our prayers, returning to Jerusalem, returning to Zion. So anybody who says, I mean, Barack Obama and his crew even paraphrased it when they were having their Seder before they went to the White House. They said, next year in the White House. I mean, even they knew what was at the end of that Seder. So these guys, they, whoever says that anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism has no idea what Judaism is actually about, and they should try cracking a book. What cracked me up are those Jewish Voices for Peace who aren't Jewish and don't want peace and actually have a lot of ties to terrorist organizations. They created a mat for Passover during the Columbia protest, and all the Hebrew was printed backwards. Show me again how you're not actually Jewish if you don't know Hebrew goes the opposite direction.
It is crazy. That is Ari Hoffman from our Seattle affiliate, KVI. Glad to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. I'm not afraid of social media. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and all the other social media, and tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on The Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank the speakers.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. This is amazing. The national debt on the day that Joe Biden took office, $27.8 trillion, just shy of $28 trillion. Today, it is just shy of $35 trillion, up $7 trillion in just about 3.5 years. Veronique DeRougie joins me now, who's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. We always turn to Veronique when it comes to economics questions. Welcome back to the program, ma'am.
Thank you for having me, Lars.
So tell me this, are we in worse trouble than maybe even the average person or a member of Congress understands? And there seems to be very little alarm at the idea that we've gone up roughly 25% in our national debt in just 3 years.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, they don't want to talk about it on the right and on the left. I mean, some Republicans do kind of pick fights, but they pick fights about things that are not unimportant, like the debt ceiling. They're important, but they're not the big picture, like, which is, you know, the driver of our future debt. And so it's hard to tell what we know for a fact about what they think if they realize. I know I can tell you that between you and your listeners and me, like one of my colleagues briefed some Senate budget people, and they basically, he was explaining to them about the state of our entitlement and the debt, and I think they were shocked. And so
they were surprised by what they heard.
I know,
members of Congress or staff.
Yes. No, member of Congress. They were senators. And so, whether they know or not, they really don't seem to be doing anything about it or to be gesturing about doing something. And I was actually looking today about the spending alone. We are spending $6.4 trillion this year alone, right? And
yep.
In 9 years, they've scheduled that we're going to be spending over $10 trillion. Spending. And that's assuming a lot of very rosy things, like interest rates are actually not going up and they may going down some. Inflation's going back to 2%. The economy's going to continue to grow. There's going to be no recession, no wars, no nothing, right? If anything changes, it's going to be an explosion of red ink on top of the red ink we already have.
Well, and all those are most of those rosy assumptions realistic at this point, that say interest rates are going to be down? Because I can remember about a year and a half ago, I was talking to somebody about mortgage rates and I said, when do you think they'll come down? He says, optimistically this fall, meaning last fall, and pessimistically, winter of 24. Well, they're not any lower right now. They're in fact higher. But I've also seen predictions that they may go even higher still this fall or after the election. And they're above 7 for a nationwide average on a 30-year mortgage. Well, that's a huge drag on home construction, on home sales, and a lot of other things that mean jobs to a lot of Americans.
Yeah, no, I mean, those assumptions are, I mean, CBO tries really hard, right, to do
Congressional Budget Office for everybody else.
Yeah, the Congressional Budget Office, which is usually what I use to kind of do projections, because budgets, especially the ones that that the president puts out, is just a political document. It has just no validity. And so they really try really hard, but there's so much they can do. And besides, their hands are constrained by the by Congress that says you only can project, you can only score what is current law. So for instance, the Trump tax cuts that are going to expire, right, at the end of in 2026, well, CBO has to score them as if revenue is going to go up because the tax cuts are going to expire, right? And we know that this is not going to happen, right? Well, I mean, we know this is not everything. Some are going to expire. Most of them are going to be kept, right? So CBO is kind of constrained in this way. And also, it can only do its best to actually say what the path of interest rates are going to be. So, for instance, the last 15 years, CBO was really wrong because it was projecting increasing interest rates when interest rates remain really, really, really low. And then when they started going up, like it was undershooting because it didn't actually think it was going to go that high. So it's a hard, hard job. It can do only what it can do. But this time, what it's done is actually presented some alternative scenarios about the productivity of the labor force, inflation, interest rates, and you see how much worse it can get.
Well, and let me ask you something. You and I have talked about the fact that two-thirds of the federal budget is entitlements. Mm-hmm. And we say that all the time. But, you know, the fact is there's a lot of other stupid government spending that is really kind of chicken feed by comparison. But it draws a lot of attention. Shrimp on treadmills, this stupid grant or that stupid grant. That if you added it all up, it probably wouldn't amount to 2% of the federal budget. But it draws people's attention away from the real problem. I mean, if the Congress wanted to be serious about this, could they go out and take a meat axe to all the stuff that draws all that attention, all the dumb, the just overtly dumb stuff, and say, okay, we've cut all the overtly dumb stuff. We've moved the marker 2%. Now, what do you want us to do? Well, what's left? Well, entitlements. That the only way to get to those, it'd be like taking somebody's budget, family budget, and saying, okay, we're cutting out movies and cable TV and your vacation this year and all the small stuff. And that hasn't got you nearly to where you have to be. And they say, well, what's left? And you say, the mortgage. You can sell your house and move to another house. You've got two cars in the driveway. You need to go to one. You'll only get to the more serious answers and the ones that'll actually make a big difference if you take care of all the small stuff first and say, we've cut all the small stuff out. Now all we've got is big stuff. What would you like to do?
Yeah, no, I mean, I at a fundamental level, I agree with you. Or another way to go about this is to say, well, actually, the small stuff, there's a lot of stupid stuff in there. But we're going to leave that because they're really the driver of the future debt is Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and interest payment on the debt. We can't do much on interest payment on the debt until we reduce the debt and interest rates go back down. So let's do reforms. It's not reforming entitlement actually does not require really actually things as radical as just basically moving into a really small house.
Right.
I mean, there are ways to do things like that are just like actually really moving the needle without.
How about putting a small copay on Medicare? Or, you know, I hate to
but
go to the means testing on Social Security because that turns it into a welfare program. But Veronique, I'm up against the stop. That's Veronique DeRougy. She's at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and we always appreciate her insights. Kind of gives you an idea where we're headed and how much it's going to take to fix this problem. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Some
Biden doesn't understand the connection between America's tanking economy and his own tax policies. Luckily, Senator John Kennedy set him straight.
If you believe that tax policy has nothing to do with the economy, then you're pretty much like a rock, only dumber.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about something that has come up as an idea that should have come up a long, long time ago. Because Oregon, almost 40 years ago, I think it's 37 years ago, Oregon decided that it would become a sanctuary state for illegal aliens. And those are people who are in the country illegally. And oftentimes they run into the cops because they're committing other crimes while they're here. And the cops were told by the sanctuary status of Oregon, you're not allowed to refer them to for deportation to Immigration and Customs Enforcement or to Customs and Border Protection. They are protected. They have a special status that is better than the status of American citizens in some ways. And then the ideas come up that maybe we should revoke that, and maybe this is the time to get it done. So I want to welcome Representative Court Boyce, who's a Republican representing Oregon's District 1 and running to retain his seat. And frankly, I'd love to hear the Democrats' view on this. I'd love to ask a couple of questions of prominent Democrats. But Court, do you think I'm going to have any luck getting Democrats to come on and explain why they want special protection for illegal aliens?
Well, unfortunately, good day, Lars. I probably would be the last person to be able to help you on that, but I can try. Hey, a little side note. I don't drink, but I'm thinking about taking it up in celebration. We got three convictions on Hunter Biden today. That little, I won't say the word, but good news. So we'll see if the president pardons him after November 5th.
Well, I got to tell you, Court, you know that Joe Biden is already on video, on TV. I think he was talking to David Muir from ABC News, and Muir asked him straight out, are you going to accept the verdict of the jury? And he said, yes. And he said, are you going to reconsider your decision not to pardon your son? And he said, no, I'm not going to pardon Hunter Biden. So, but then again, Joe lies a fair amount and has for the better part of 50 years. So who knows if he's telling the truth or not. If he goes back on his word, we're going to run that soundbite over and over again. But you're right. I'm glad to see the verdict as well. And notice the jury took all of 3 hours over 2 days. And part of that, I think, involved a late lunch. So I don't think it took them very long to make the decision.
You know, that says a lot, the 3 hour period for the jury there. And my goodness, you know what's going to happen is the sentencing won't be until after the next president takes office. So I hope I'm wrong on that, but I bet $500 to a Portland donut shop that's been vandalized that we will see that young man. Unfortunately, will be pardoned. We can talk about whatever you want.
Well, I do want to ask you about the sanctuary stuff, but on that note. Judge Noriega, who's overseeing this case, she's the one who threw out the sweetheart plea deal that the Biden DOJ engineered for the president's son last year, which I thought was blatantly political. Joe Biden is, and we ran a soundbite with him earlier, saying, oh, all these charges are just their way of getting at me. Yeah, somehow the Republicans engineered to make your son a crack addict by his own account, to make him go out and buy one gun and be in possession of at least two, because there are videos of him showing him with a prostitute, cocaine, and another gun, not the gun he bought at the shop in Wilmington, Delaware, but some other gun that still hasn't been explained. He was in possession of that gun. And you say, and Joe says, yeah, they set that up to get at me. Oh, how did we make your son into a crack addict and a felon?
Well, he's also a pedophile. We have pictures.
Well, Joe or Hunter or both.
Well, probably both, but we certainly have a picture with Hunter. He should have been arrested right then.
I agree. Well, I think his dad is a creepy pedophile as well. I mean, we know that his daughter talked about, daddy taking showers with her at an inappropriate age in her diary. We know that Joe Biden behaves really strangely around small children and young girls, and also women who are not part of his family. He let's put it this way, he gets overly familiar with them, and he does it in front of TV cameras. So you got to wonder what kind of weird perverseness there is going on in that family.
It just crushes your heart to see what the victims have to deal with. It's the entire culture. Lars, you remember 30 years ago during the Republican National Convention, Pat Buchanan warned us what was coming. You might recall his speech. It was just tremendous. And they castigated him and went after him verbally, just, wow, crazy, and all the rest of it. Yet we're seeing that happen now, like I say, many years later. So the people I run with, they'll keep peace at any cost, but they do not want to give up the United States of America and their liberty, needless to say.
No, and you know what Joe said about that today in front of that gun-grabbing group, the Moms Demand Action? He made that same statement that he's made several times, where we know why the Second Amendment's there. This is what I'm saying. It's there to protect against a tyrannical government. And Joe Biden literally threatens and says, no, you can't use it against a tyrannical government. We have F-15s. So this is the head of the United States government threatening citizens, saying there's no way that you could hold off a tyrannical government because we have bigger weapons than you do. Is that an appropriate thing for a president to say to the citizens of this country?
You know, he probably had the red background, too. If it was a press release, or excuse me, a press period there, I doubt it lasted very long. And, yes, there's probably two hero Marines standing on the side. But, you know, I watched, get this, the Ben-Hur movie from 60 years ago, Charlton Heston, and there's one line in there, I'll abbreviate here, but it basically says, we have to keep our swords until all men are gentle, and I'll never forget that line.
And that's a very good way to put it. Let me ask you about why we are only now seeing Republicans standing up saying it's time to reconsider Oregon's sanctuary status.
You know, 90% of your viewers, Lars, understand there's some very bad people coming into our state. Let's just put it this way. We have, in addition to that, we have the Wolverines, Grizzlies, and Wolves that are putting our ranchers out of business, forced on us in eastern Oregon. No wonder they want to go to Idaho. We have offshore wind towers on the west side that we know don't work and are horribly costly. We have Antifa from the north, and we have the cartels and Chinese nationalists coming over the south border. So our government needs to protect us. That's their only job, state and federal level. So we need to help them. And, of course, we need to get control of the Oregon legislature. We have a chance, Lars. All the times I've been on with you, I forgot to thank you for 2010 when my father passed. You called in on the middle of your radio show, and I couldn't went over better and said a little tribute to him. It was just incredible. But
he was a great
guy. Used to say, yeah, thank you. A famous sheriff and Marine, one of the first American GIs into Hiroshima after the bombs were dropped, 19-year-old corporal, the stories he had. But he used to say 10% of the Democrats should just as well have feet on both ends. Now, if he were alive today, he would say 60%. So, Lars, we need the 40% that do have it right, are figuring it out, and want to help us save Oregon, back to normal, back to basics, back to common sense, not safer streets, but safe streets, and just return Oregon to healthy communities, healthy neighborhoods. I hope that makes sense.
That's Court Boyce. He's running for state representative to retain his seat in the Oregon legislature, and let's hope they vote down sanctuary status, and Washington State should do the same. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Starts here. Visit goto.org.
Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I want to talk about farming, and I want to talk about energy, and the fact that the energy policies of the Biden administration, and unfortunately, too many of the blue states out there, are going to wreak havoc on something very, very important. Now, if you're thinking I'm talking about gasoline or diesel, not that specifically. I like to sit down and have dinner on occasion, and dinner comes from energy. And usually it comes from fossil energy. And somehow we're being told, no, we're going to get it some other way. We'll buy enough Chi-Com made solar panels and windmills, and we'll be able to replace all the current fossil fuels. I mean, if you don't believe that that's how extreme they are, I'd point out that almost 2 years ago, Joe Biden gave a State of the Union address in which he said, why, we're not even going to use oil 10 years from now. Now, everybody laughed. He actually got a laugh line from the Republicans in the chamber. The Democrats apparently took it seriously. So I want to talk to Bonner Cohen, who is a senior policy analyst at the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, otherwise known as CFACT, about what the farmers are doing to fight back against policies from the blue states that are going to wreak havoc on the red states. Bonner, welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here, Lars.
I understand that there is a coalition now, 19 state attorneys general, who are going after a bunch of blue states saying your fossil fuel policies, which you're trying to foist on the rest of us, are going to do real damage to America's ability to feed itself.
Yes, these 19 state attorneys general have asked the Supreme Court to step in and keep a whole bunch of blue states. They've cited five, but actually they're considerably more than five, not to mention a whole bunch of municipalities, from using state and county laws to sue energy companies, saying that their failure to address climate change and their emissions of greenhouse gases are endangering the planet, endangering the health and well-being of the citizens in their states. So what they want to do is they want to be compensated. This is a gigantic shakedown of the oil and gas companies, which are seen as a very inviting target because they have considerable financial resources. And wouldn't it be better if those resources were put at the disposal of the political class in, say, Sacramento, California, Boston, Massachusetts, New York City, New York? You can go down the list of the usual suspects. And what they're doing is they're using local laws, hoping to adjudicate these things in state courts, where they will have the home court advantage, to engage in state-driven decarbonization. This is what this is all about. And you're quite right to raise the question about farmers, who, among other things, feed us, and without whom we would not be able to meet our daily dietary needs. Farmers are in the bull's eye of all of this, because we are told that their farming practices need to change. They, too, need to decarbonize, and the Biden administration even has plans to replace fossil fuel-driven equipment like tractors and combines with electric chargers. But you can see what a magnificent job they're doing putting charging stations around the country to take
you care mean of they've spent these. They've spent $7 billion, and in 2.5 years, almost 3 years, they've managed to build 7 electric car chargers.
That's right.
Out of the 500,000 they say they're going to do,
has come online.
No, and Bonner, but I want people to think a little more broadly, because it's not just the equipment, is it? Because I know that all of us can say, I mean, I grew up in farming communities and around dairy farmers and other kinds of farmers, and you say, okay, the tractor runs on diesel. Do you think most people get it that the pesticides are made with petrochemicals? The herbicides are made with petrochemicals. The fertilizer, for goodness sake, is made with petrochemicals. Now, I know John Deere has a crazy electric tractor. It will go all of, I think, a half a mile out in any given direction.
And it with a strong wind behind it, yeah.
I'm not kidding. It literally has a cord attached to it. It doesn't have a battery. It runs on a cord on a big spool, and it looks like something crazy that some kid described. Oh, we're going to have electric tractors, and they all have a giant extension cord. And I'm not joking. John Deere actually has one of these. But how do you make electric fertilizer?
No, they haven't. You see, what they don't understand, how many people imposing these policies on the rest of us have ever spent more than 5 minutes on a farm, if that. But this is an assault on the entire agricultural infrastructure, which does not work in the 21st century without fossil fuels. But if you have a policy demanding decarbonization, to stop and take that to the next level, these people actually want to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, bury it someplace, do something else with it, not realizing that carbon dioxide is absolutely essential for plant growth, including crops.
Right? It's plant food.
It's exactly. Do these people never take a science course in the 10th grade? Obviously not. And if you want to create conditions ripe for famine, particularly in vulnerable countries around the world, sub-Saharan Africa, Indian subcontinent, but elsewhere, all you need to do is reduce atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide, and bingo, you will get it. And this is what these people are aiming at, claiming preposterously that today's levels of atmospheric levels of CO2 are high. Actually, they're not. Historically, they're low, and they're still rebounding from extremely low, dangerously low levels during the little ice age, which took place roughly between 2050 and 1800. The upshot of all of this is that agriculture is under the gun. And if agriculture is under the gun, under the false pretense of, you know, addressing quote-unquote climate change, that means that our well-being, our ability to have a healthy diet, and farmers' ability to make a living is in real jeopardy.
Well, let me ask you about this.
Decarbonization, we need recarbonization.
I'm with you. But, Bonner, let me ask you a constitutional question. Because if you have California and New York, so close to 80 million people, so a big chunk of America's population, and they say, we're not going to buy any food that's grown with fossil fuels. They have the ability to affect the entire national food market, because a farmer says, I can't sell potatoes or rice or beans or anything else in California or New York unless we decarbonize. They want to drive the policy. Doesn't that run afoul of the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Yeah. And this is something that's going to be have to be settled in court, because they're following the same roadmap they did with gasoline-powered vehicles. California and other states have said no more gasoline-powered vehicles can be sold in our state after 2035. Well, if California, a huge market, and a whole bunch of other states do that, the automobile manufacturers will have no choice but to switch to EVs, for which there is a woefully inadequate market.
Absolutely right. That's Bonner Cohen, who's a senior policy analyst at the Committee for Constructive Tomorrow. That is CFAC. Bonner, thanks very much. Back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. Naysayers always go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Rick.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm kind of reminded of a Winston Churchillism who said, don't worry, the Americans will always do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And I was reminded of that when I saw the stories by our friend Jonathan Cho, who's a journalist at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. The Northwest has tried one of the craziest illegal drug experiments that you can possibly imagine. And now the left, the folks who are actually running the show, both in Olympia, in Salem, and in downtown Seattle and downtown Portland, they're saying, let's try everything we can except the things we actually know work. And the latest one is gift cards for drug addicts. And I'm not even kidding, and no, it's not Babylon Bee. Jonathan Cho joins me now. Jonathan, welcome back to the program. Would you mind telling my audience, we're going to give gift cards at taxpayer expense to people who are addicted to hard drugs?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be another failed social experiment. These progressives, these policymakers, they feel like, they don't ever deal with the actual root causes to these issues, you know, things like actual intervention and making sure people get the treatment beds and detox, but instead they want to give these incentives so these addicts can then, you know, use the gift cards or, you know, hit certain milestones and get this stuff. And if you actually ask the addicts on the streets, will it make a difference? They say no. They don't need gift cards. They just want their latest hit.
Well, and isn't there a likelihood? I mean, I guess I'm just thinking, Jonathan, I'm not a medical expert. I'm, as Ketanji Brown Jackson said, I'm not a biologist. But if you hand anything that's worth cash, to an addict, isn't it likely that the addict is going to turn that thing through some mechanism into cash and buy drugs with it?
That's the other reality that a lot of the policymakers don't want to acknowledge. You talk to the addicts on the streets, you know, who most of them, they'll steal items at the local Walmart or Target and sell them on the street for pennies on the dollar so they can buy the fentanyl or meth. The real question I have is, what is the accountability structure going to look like? Who's actually going to track, you know, how these gift cards are distributed, you know, if they're actually being used, and the success rates? That's what I want to know.
And by the way, this is all coming out of Bruce Harrell's office. The mayor of Seattle is the guy who's driving this thing, or at least he's signed off on it. I'm sure somebody brought him the idea and said, hey, why don't we try this? But the mayor had to say yes to this. This is his baby, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it was driven by Council President Sarah Nelson, who's a moderate, and she's a former addict as well, alcohol, and she beat that.
Well, and the other thing about this is a 12-week program, and as I understand, you fill in the details, but instead of doing inpatient treatment, and I'm not sure that always works, it didn't work with Hunter Biden, but there are people who say these 30-day treatment programs don't work. It's not enough time. So this one's 12 weeks. But it's not done in a clinic. This is going to be at home on their own, sort of on the honor system for the drug addicts.
Yeah, and that's what's so mind-boggling right now. Who's going to actually be walking with them? You talk to most addicts who have recovered, and they'll say not only were they in this program, they had somebody walking with them every step of the way. Where's the mentoring process? Again, where's the encouragement along the journey? So, again, it comes down to the word accountability. What will accountability look like, and how are they going to measure success or failure?
And in fact, the other thing I wanted to get from you, because I haven't seen any other reporting on this, I'm talking to Jonathan Cho from the Discovery Institute. They say these will be low-dollar gift cards in cash. So not only are they going to say a little bit of incentive will get you to stay with the program, how much are they talking about giving to the addicts?
$100 gift cards. I mean, that's what I'm hearing initially. And there's, you know, hundreds more dollars in gift cards out there if they, again, meet certain measures, barometers, and milestones. But again, what I'm hearing is that, of course, there'll be some people who take this offer and they'll go with it and try it. But others are saying, no, why do they need gift cards when, again, they can get access to the drugs on the streets, and that's what they want to do right now?
Well, and that's the funny thing is that, Jonathan, I know. I mean, I've never used hard drugs in my life, and it's scary to think about getting addicted. That if you say took legitimate pharmaceuticals because of pain of one kind or another, that's actually about 3% of all the drug overdoses that happen affect people who originally were given regular pharmaceuticals. Most of this is party drugs, people who take it because they want to get high. But if you say addiction is notoriously hard to quit, but we can get somebody to quit by giving them basically $16 a day for a week, $100 a week for 12 weeks will help beat one of the toughest addictions in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll have to wait and see, right? This is clearly a social experiment. Officials say that it's, you know, worked in other places to a certain degree, but can this be, again, rolled out at scale? And again, how are they going to measure success? and failure? That's what I want to know, and that's unclear right now, Lars.
I mean, because that's the thing, and if you're trusting the bureaucracy to actually track it, when they tell you we've done this with 1,000 people and 100 of them beat drugs, you're going to have to trust that the numbers and the accounting done by the very program that wants to show success, that we can trust their numbers to measure whether or not it accomplished.
Right, and that's the cycle we're used to, at least here in the Pacific Northwest and Seattle, where, you know, you'll have these progressive ideas thrown out there, you know, social experiments, no accountability, and then when it doesn't work, they'll ask for even more money. They'll always say, we need more money. This didn't work, so we need more money to try again. So, again, we'll see if, the officials have woken up from, you know, failed mistakes in the past, but this is a new idea, so it's a wait-and-see approach.
You got to see the stories that Jonathan Cho does. Jonathan, thanks so much for the work you do at the Discovery Institute.
All right, take care, Lars.
That is Jonathan Cho from Seattle. Now, it's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Show. Network.